What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Well, a tremendous Friday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. This is our program that's primarily geared towards our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. But if you are a Catholic and perhaps there's something, some teaching about the church that you're not real clear about, or perhaps you're in conversation with one of our separated brothers and sisters and you have come up against a question that you're having a hard time answering, we would love to talk to you today. Pick up the phone and give us a call. And if you're not Catholic, answer that question we ask every day. What is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? The numbers are 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. That is a toll-free telephone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. If you're outside of North America, your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985, and you can always send us an email. The email address is ctc@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, sitting in today for Tom Price. Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Ace McKay handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as the title of the show would indicate, Dr. David Anders, how are you?
Jack, doing great. How about you?
Terrific, thank you.
Glad to hear it.
Ben has written in, and he wants to know if you can talk about the moral relativism we seem to be living in and how to navigate these times. Can we be optimistic about the future? And I'd be anxious to hear your answer to this question as I personally enter my fourth decade of battling moral relativism.
Okay, thanks. Well, you know, I don't think that the civilization is as relativistic as its proponents would like to claim, right? My general experience of people who claim to be moral relativists is they employ that kind of rhetoric when they want to take down your moral system, but they are very quick to moralize about those issues that are near and dear to their hearts, right? So you find, you know, whatever ideological or social position is associated with their camp, and they're gonna defend those to the hilt, and they're gonna, you know, cry injustice all day long against people that don't agree with their view of the universe. So I don't think moral relativism. I think that's kind of a red herring, actually. You know, I mean, actual moral relativism, the belief that you know, there are no fundamental universal moral standards. You will occasionally find radical thinkers that will push that all the way to the hilt. But I mean, in my experience, that's just not how people operate. So what we're talking about really are incommensurate moral frameworks. And I think I made the point on the show the other day, if I didn't, I'll make it again, that you cannot deductively argue someone into a moral framework. And I'll give you a good illustration of that. I remember hearing a story that Peter Kreft told many years ago about a course he taught at Boston College on abortion. And he wanted to make the point that abortion and infanticide are morally equivalent. And so he laid out a lot of scientific and philosophical arguments that you should not distinguish between abortion and infanticide. And after the class, a couple of young ladies walked up to him and they said, "Dr. Kreft, we really appreciated this class. You've persuaded us. We now believe that abortion and infanticide are morally equivalent." And he said, "Oh, good, so now you're against abortion." They said, "Oh, no, now we're in favor of infanticide." and yeah. You know, the reason that makes sense in their universe is that how do you rank order moral values? And, I mean, the church has an answer to that question. But, I mean, everybody has moral convictions. Everybody has things that they think are the right way to go. And those are usually pre-philosophical. They're embedded in, you know, your culture and upbringing, your situatedness, you know, towards your own body, towards other people. And they're really deep intuitions that you have. And then what people do in moral philosophy is they go out and look for theoretical arguments to defend those basic intuitions, right? And that's why arguing people into the truth is rarely successful. So what you do is you enculturate them into the truth. And Hollywood understands this very well, as does Madison Avenue. You blanket the airwaves and discourse and community with your messaging, and you package it in a way to make it seem shiny and beautiful and attractive and so forth. And you draw people in that way, and then you give them the theoretical arguments. Well, the church does the same thing. It evangelizes through beauty. That's something that Pope Francis has emphasized a lot. It's something that Bishop Robert Barron emphasized tremendously in his whole evangelistic outreach. But it's not new to these thinkers. It's been part of the church's tradition for a very long time. So I think if you want to convert a culture, Catholics have to live the truth, goodness, and beauty of the Catholic faith, make it manifest in their lives, their families, their parishes. And the wreckage of the culture will, you know, be the tidal wave that draws people to the shores of the church if we have the infrastructure in place and the lives that make it attractive. 2025 was a kind of a bumper crop year for OCIA candidates around the world, not just in the United States, and not just converting from one form of Christianity to another, but unchurched people, unbaptized people in secular Europe were flowing into the church and into RCIO programs in unprecedented numbers. And they've grown weary of the sense of being adrift in a culture that has thin values. And many of them found their way into the Catholic Church. Honestly, if I've read the sociology on this and I've talked to some of the leading figures, through Catholic social media, and in France in particular I'm thinking of, because that's the country I know more about, as people have just told their stories about their relationship to God and to Christ and the Catholic faith, and they've been able to get a hearing, and in that way capturing the moral imagination has drawn more and more young people into the church in recent years. So I think that's the approach. That's not a bid just for social media. It's a bid for living your faith publicly and authentically with truth, goodness, and beauty.
I want to follow up on that in just a second after the break. I want to touch on one, have you illustrate a little more deeply one point that you made. If you'd like to be part of the program, we want to hear what you think. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. If you'd like to be part of the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. Got a great feature publication for you from EWTN Publishing, Making a Holy Lent, 40 Meditations to Prepare You for the Church's Holiest Season. Our good friend Father Bill Casey, a Father of Mercy, turns our attention to Jesus in brief reflections on topics ranging from the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist to the role that the Blessed Virgin Mary plays in every healthy prayer life. Drawing on years of experience as a retreat master and a regular EWTN host, Father Casey leavens each of these holy topics with a refreshing dose of common sense. Not only is this book perfectly suited for your Lenten devotions, you will find yourself turning to it many times during the year to remind you of the ever-urgent need for repentance and rebirth. Making a Holy Lent, 40 Meditations to Prepare You for the Church's Holiest Season by Father Bill Casey, available at EWTN's Religious Catalog. That's EWTNRC.com. And our first email of the day was talking about how to combat the moral relativism that we see in our society. And during your answer, you talked about the importance of living these principles that we believe in out. And we were talking during the break that a lot of people have a very strong and vast intellectual moral code that is very easy to uphold when the consequences don't apply directly to you or create consequences for you. But when you find yourself in one of those situations, oftentimes we find that maybe we didn't hold those moral positions quite as strongly as we thought we did.
You know, there was a term that entered the English lexicon around 2015. The reality has been around since the dawn of time, but the terminology was fairly new. The term is virtue signaling.
Yeah.
This is a result of the social media revolution, of course. And this is putting up hashtags and posting to your Facebook page and wearing the T-shirt and getting the bumper sticker and putting the sign in your yard and whatever else form of demonstration you need to show the people whose approval you want that you hold the right ideology, that you affirm the right values. And I've always thought that St. Thomas Aquinas had something to say about this. When you read St. Thomas on the virtue of justice, one of the first questions he poses is virtue a justice of the will or the intellect? Is it a justice of the will or the intellect? Is it primarily about what you think, or is it primarily about what you're motivated towards? And Thomas concludes that it's a virtue of the will, not of the intellect. And it always struck me that what lies behind virtue signaling is implicitly the idea that I'm a good person provided I think the right things. If I think the right things, I'm a good person. When in reality, you're a good person because you do the right things. And, I saw this illustrated powerfully. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day, and he was having a difficult time with a relative who held political positions very different from his own, and he found to hold the wrong opinions to be reprehensible, but he was deeply impressed when the very same relative stopped her car and got out to hold a bleeding person who had been in a car wreck and wait until the ambulance could come. The lived behavior showed charity and justice, even though their ideological differences inclined him to see this person as unjust, right? It's not a matter so much of the will as it is of the moral behavior that flows essentially from the will. And so Catholics are guilty of this too, right? We have our causes, we have our political opinions, and it's very possible for a Catholic to carry the sign, to go on the march, and yet when the rubber hits the road, not to actually step up and be there for other human beings.
To the phones we go. Tracy's up first today in Round Lake Beach, Illinois, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Tracy, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
Hi. I was hearing you speak about Lent, and I just returned to Catholicism about 2 years ago. And I did take the OCIA class at one church, but they never taught us what Lent was. They only told us what we were supposed to do, and that was it. They didn't say anything about following prayers or anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
So
sure.
I ended up going to another church. So when Lent came about, I dove into it. I got books on it. I got everything. Every question I've had is answered. And I find it to be the most beautiful time in the world right now. Because even though we're sorrowful for what we ourselves did to the Lord Jesus Christ, it is a glorious time because he's resurrected for us.
Well, Tracy, I really appreciate the call. And I agree with you. I'm sorry that your formation in RCA was deficient and that you didn't feel like you were adequately formed in the church's liturgical calendar and the meaning thereof. I have to confess that I feel the same lack in me. I'm always trying to catch up on calendar and liturgy issues. It's one of my weak spots in Catholic formation. But I enjoy living the liturgy and I enjoy living the calendar. And it always draws the different aspects of Christ's life to mind, and because you're embedded in them and in your temporal orientation. It was beautiful to me the way the church has so many ways of teaching. So many dimensions of human experience can be touched by a catechetical message and draw us closer to Christ. And I'm so glad that you found your way to the experience of Lent in a way that is edifying to you and helping you draw closer to our Lord. So thanks for sharing that testimony.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833 888-3986. Tom is in the great state of Florida, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130 today. Tom, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Well, thank you for taking my call, and I have learned so very, very much over the last years listening to this program. I appreciate it greatly. Regarding what Dr. Anders is talking about, I agree wholeheartedly that the moral relativism is not really the right way to define what we're going through right now culturally, but I think it's a first cousin. It's a sense of normlessness. You do you, I do me, I got my truth, you got your truth, I have to respect, blah, blah, blah. And so we've eroded universal norms to the point where there probably aren't many.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So, you know, I think most people, I mean, there may be some rare exceptions, but my experience is that most people think that there is an objective world out there someplace, and that it is, to a certain extent, knowable. I mean, that's the presupposition behind the whole scientific enterprise, is that we can actually make objective discoveries about reality, and they can improve our lives and give us deeper knowledge and penetration. And, you know, when you apply that same kind of conviction to social realities and to symbolic realities, you can run into difficulties, because we look at two different cultures and we see that they construe those realities in very different ways. And that's not a bad thing. And sometimes dialogue with the other can expose you to aspects of reality that you were not inclined to see initially. And that different perspective can open up dimensions of reality for you, and you can get a better grasp of objective reality by dialoguing with people who don't agree with you. The false conclusion to draw is that because people fundamentally disagree, there is no truth to be obtained, or if there is a truth, it's unobtainable. And then we collapse into relativism.
We've got an email here from Theo, Dr. Anders, and it kind of follows up what you just were talking about a little bit on one level. Theo says, psychedelic drugs are very popular again, and many people share similar experiences about communing with entities or elves. Do you think this is in our mind, or is some kind of portal being opened?
Right. So, first of all, what is the appeal of psychedelic drugs? You know, beyond talking to elves, all right? I mean, in general, if you go back to the psychedelic movement of the 1960s, people are looking for transcendence. People are looking for transcendence. They want to get out of and escape the day-to-day normal reality that was perceived to be oppressive or boring or uninteresting or spiritually unenlightened or so forth. And psychedelic drugs have the effect of making people feel like they've had transcendent or spiritual experiences. And there was a whole movement in the 1960s that embraced that sense and really promoted it. Timothy Leary and the League for Spiritual Discovery and all of this, trying to make outlandish claims about the benefits of psychedelics in terms of connecting people to the great beyond. And I think as Catholics, we can disapprove of the methodology. We can be sympathetic to the yearning, right, to the desire. St. Augustine, of course, is famous for the quote, "Our hearts are restless, O Lord, until they rest in Thee." Human beings are restless. They're existentially disoriented. They long for truth, goodness, and beauty, and a connection to something bigger than themselves, something that they don't understand, a vast reality, an ocean of meaning in which they can sink themselves and be transformed. I mean, that's a very natural inclination. Now, the phenomenological aspects of drug use, the bodily sensations that accompany it that can be so powerful and overwhelming, are deceitful, because they make one, they trick one into thinking that transcendence is merely a matter of sentiment or merely a matter of bodily or sensible experience. And it's so much more than that. And it's quite possible, of course, in fact, it's normative in the Catholic tradition, that we have to pass through periods of deep aridity, even pain and suffering, to be properly transformed and to experience the transcendence of Christ's personality, right? Who is ultimately about how can you love the other, you know, with the love of charity that would die on the cross, right? My experience is that psychedelics do not produce that kind of transformation. In fact, you know, I remember back in my high school days talking to somebody who had been at a Grateful Dead concert where there's lots of psychedelic drugs. And, you know, they had some little bauble that they had, and some tripped out woman came up and started talking in mystical gobbledygook about how, you know, everything is one and we're all one and what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine. And that justified her seconds later stealing the bauble and walking off with it, because after all, there's no private ownership. You know, it's just, it was just nonsense. It's just utter nonsense. And that's very different from the kind of transcendence that a Catholic wants to experience. There are experiences in Catholic mysticism where people go into ecstatic trances. Interestingly, when you read the great mystics like Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, they are completely unimpressed by such experiences. They recognize that they happen. Teresa of Avila once wrote in her interior castle that there were nuns in her convent that were going into rapture, and the early modern Spanish word for rapture sounds a lot like the Spanish word for foolishness. And she made a play on words and said, they call it rapture, I call it foolishness. Because if it's not ultimately conforming the will to be like Jesus, it's not worth anything. Now, your question is, do I think that people are actually talking to sentient agents, whether they be elves or other things, when they get involved in psychedelic drugs? Well, my inclination would be no, right? Because one of the effects of psychedelics is to cause hallucinations. I mean, that's integral to the functionality of the thing. Now, you know, are you opening yourself up to malevolent spiritual forces in a more general sense? Yes, and I wouldn't put it past the devil to make use of that technology. But my default sort of prima facie conclusion, if someone tells me they're tripping on acid and they talk to an elf, is let's cut back on the acid, dude.
Back to the phones we go. Andrea is in the great state of Iowa listening on KMMK Radio today. Andrea, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Oh, hi. I'm a little conflicted about evangelization, because I'm afraid that if the human race ever figures out what the Catholic Church has in the Eucharist, I will never be able to get close to another church. It will be so crowded.
Well, I really appreciate the question. That would be a good problem to have. I don't feel that same degree of anxiety about it, because, you know, in spite of our best efforts, you know, we're evangelizing and more people are coming to RCA, but currently, sociologically, we are still losing more people than we're gaining in Catholicism. So we're a long way from even like tipping the counter towards like actual growth, right? You know, I mean, in North America. So if we actually had exponential growth to the point that there was no more room in the churches, well, we would build new churches. But I think we're a long way off from that.
You know, this isn't exactly what Andrea is talking about, but it reminds me of something that you hear every once in a while with regard to shying away from evangelization, and that would be that you are creating culpability that otherwise would not be there.
Right. Well, you know, the church does have a teaching on that, that if you understand the church's teaching on the necessity for being Catholic and you don't follow it, then you know, you're in a bad way. And extrapolating, why would that be the case, right? I mean, why would God seemingly arbitrarily hold someone responsible just for knowledge, right? And I think you have to go a little bit deeper and ask, do they know to the point that their conscience is convicted? And that it's not enough just to know the fact. Lots of people know factually that the church says it's necessary for salvation, but they don't find the claim credible. It's different if you actually are persuaded, yes, this is what I ought to do, and then you don't join. Well, then you're fundamentally disobeying your own conscience and putting yourself in a deuce of a position. And this is what happened to me when before I became Catholic. I had about a year or two where I was intellectually persuaded of the truth of Catholicism, and I held back because it was tremendously inconvenient to me to become Catholic. And I continued to go to the Presbyterian Church, but I was a complete useless lump there because I didn't believe it. And finally, my non-Catholic wife said to me, "You're a useless lump. You know, go ahead and join the Catholic Church, because you're not going to be good to anybody until you do." And so I did.
Thanks, Andrew. We appreciate the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number. Wide open phone lines on this Friday. 833-288-3986. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders. One of our great EWTN radio partners needs to hear from you next week. Our good friends at Iowa Catholic Radio, with 8 stations serving Iowa, kicks off their spring fundraiser on Tuesday. No matter where you live, please support your local Catholic radio station. Listen, these folks are worthy of your support. They're working awfully hard for not a lot of money, usually, to be able to evangelize over the radio airwaves, and we would appreciate it if you would consider them in your giving plans. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. We go to my homeland next, the great state of Missouri. Anna is a first-time caller listening on Covenant Radio. Anna, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm calling about a recent conversation I had with some friends who aren't Catholic, and they were turned off when they had attended Mass in the past because of the kind of strictness and rigidity about the Mass. And they felt unwelcomed and that kind of thing. So my question is how to dialogue with non-Catholic friends, coworkers, et cetera, about the reason why the liturgy involves certain rites, rituals, patterns to it, in a way that can open their eyes to the truth and beauty of it rather than to be turned off by the...
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I'll say, first of all, I don't know what your friend's experience was, but if somebody in general tells me they went to Mass and they felt unwelcome, I'm inclined to believe them. And it is an unfortunate fact that sometimes people go to liturgy and they have unwelcoming experiences. And that is a performative contradiction, because the Church tells us, St. Thomas Aquinas tells us, that the Eucharist is the sign of the Church's unity, and it should be expressed in fraternal charity. And Pope Benedict tells us, in his encyclical on love, that any Eucharist that does not bring forth concrete acts of charity is inherently fractured. And so it's possible to have a kind of precision about the celebration of the Mass, but to do so in a way that lacks charity. And St. Paul, we know, tells us this is his one major criteria for liturgy. He says you can do everything you want in liturgy all day long, but if you lack charity, it's all for nothing. And so Catholic parishes, Catholic priests, Catholic lay people need to be alert that just because we have the liturgy celebrated according to the rubrics with exact precision, if we in fact lack charity towards our neighbor, then we're not actually benefiting from the Mass the way it's intended to benefit us. So I do want to throw that out there. Now, in terms of the functionality of liturgy and the rationale of liturgy, there are liturgies all over the place outside of Catholicism that are embedded into social culture that people don't need instructions on how to participate in. And, I live in Alabama, where the number one religion in Alabama is SEC football, closely followed by the Southern Baptist Convention. And sometimes they're indistinguishable, right? Except when you have a Catholic football coach for the Tide, but we don't need more, right? Now, when people go to football games, what are they doing, right? I mean, they are participating in a corporate event. And I haven't been to a football game in a long time, but the last time I was there, the stranger next to me didn't give a fig whether he said hello to me or shook my hand or not, right? I was not there to make friends with the guy next to me, right? But there's a sense of solidarity that is derived nonetheless from, being there with your team and rooting for them on the field. And you have all the ritual and the fanfare of the pennants and the T-shirts and the band and all the rest of it. And it's all meant to evoke this sense of corporate solidarity and participation. And you know why you do that, right? Because you want to feel like you belong to something bigger than yourself for which you can root, right? There's a purpose here. It may be artificial. It may not translate into the rest of life. I don't know. The football player Jack here may disagree with me on that. But, it takes place in a very restricted domain, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not intended to translate to the rest of life. It's just, you're just there for that sense of participation. And that is not the only reason we go to Mass by any stretch of the imagination, but it is not an inconsequential part of why we have liturgy, right? That St. Thomas, when he asks in the Summa, why do we have sacraments? One of the reasons he gives is that the sacraments are the thing that actualizes, as it were, draws into one place the corporate experience of being a Christian. And, you know, I had a kind of somewhat disaffected young person, a Catholic, ask me the other day, what should I try to get out of Mass? And this after a particularly uninspiring homily. And I said, well, some days, maybe the only thing you get out of Mass is a sense of signaling your solidarity with the Catholic tradition for 2,000 years. And I don't want you to balk at that. Like, that is a very powerful motive. It may not be the only motive, but me personally, when I became Catholic, I didn't know anybody in my local parish at all. But when I stepped in for the first time, because I had knowledge of Christian history, stepping through that door, I felt like I was going through the wardrobe into Narnia. I felt like I was stepping into a reality that transcended me and put me in communion, not just with the guy in the pew next to me, but with St. Augustine, with St. Thomas, with St. Francis, with the popes and the bishops and the faithful going back for 2,000 years. Now, you're not going to evoke that by taking a stranger who has no formation and putting them in the Mass. I am conscious that this came to me really heavily one day when I attended a Mass at our local Benedictine monastery. And it was beautiful. It was gorgeous. And being Benedictine, it was predictably long. It was probably an hour and a half long. The monks all processed in. The abbot comes in. It was all said with great reverence. The abbot preached a magnificent homily that was just saturated in the language of Catholic tradition. And they all walked out. And I remember thinking, I loved that. And if I had brought a Baptist here today, they would have understood absolutely nothing that happened. And one important takeaway is that the church should not necessarily change its liturgy to accommodate the non-Catholic. In the ancient world, the non-Catholic was not expected to go to Mass. And there's a remnant of this in the Byzantine liturgy when the deacon stands and says, the doors, the doors. The doors, the doors. And he's not talking about the rock band. It was in order to literally close the doors on the catechumens and shut them out from the mysteries, right? The Mass is the sacrifice of the church. That's why in RCIA, which is a rite, R-I-T-E, it's an order in the church, there are these progressive moments of illumination and scrutinies and so forth that are meant to draw you into the mystery of the Mass and of the drama of being a Catholic and to educate you so that you can come to appreciate it. And then once you have that education, that formation, and you step into it, then you can have that sense of deep participation in the ritual, which culminates, of course, in the sacrifice of the Mass, which is the body and blood of Christ. But one doesn't have that conviction merely because it has been stated, right? I mean, it's a gift of the Spirit, but it has to be enculturated into you. And so, you know, this is how liturgy works. And like I said, we have examples of that kind of thing outside the Catholic Church that people engage in all the time. They don't have to ask why they do it because they've been brought up to it and they understand the experience from the inside out. Try taking a European to an American football game. They don't have the same response as they're going to have to soccer, right? And the same thing is kind of similar. You don't just take somebody immediately out of the Baptist church, drop them in a Catholic liturgy, and expect it to be intelligible to them.
Is that helpful for you, Anna?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much. We appreciate that. Let me hear your take on this a little bit, Dr. Anders. The Catholic liturgy is not about us.
The orientation of the church of the liturgy is vertical. It's from us through the altar to God. Okay. It's by contrast, you know, my experience of worship in the Presbyterian Church is it was from the pulpit to the congregation. It was oriented towards us. And then some of the mega churches, you throw in the lights, the sound, the smoke machine, the band, you know, the winsome message, you know, filled with humor and so forth. And it really is about entertainment. You know, if the Mass were about entertainment, we've lost.
Yeah.
Like, we're dead. We're never going to compete with Netflix, right?
Right.
Now, you know, it is about us in this extent, right? God doesn't need liturgy. Right, but Christ institutes the liturgy to give us a way of being drawn into the dynamic of his own self-sacrificial life so that it ritualizes for us what Paul says when he commands, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. So it actualizes for us in a ritual way that dimension of Christian living, which is to give ourselves entirely to God through Jesus.
Yeah, and I was going to suggest that corporately, it's not about us. It's not about me when I go to Mass. And as I understand the reality of that and the truth of that, it suddenly makes it all about me. And that's the giving nature of the God we serve.
Right, because it elicits in you a shift in perspective that fundamentally changes your orientation to reality.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Thanks, Anna. That was a great question. We appreciate it. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still time for your calls at 833-288-3986. Mark is now up next, a first-time caller from the great state of Minnesota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Mark, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Dr. Anders.
Hi.
So, I've always struggled with the reasoning behind why we don't eat meat on Friday. The only best justification I've been told is it's an ancient tradition where meat was a delicacy, and we're fasting from that. And now we're being asked to eat, you know, seafood or fish, which is more of a delicacy now. And then also, you know, we have Lenten fish fries where we're doing the opposite of fasting. And I just can't wrap my mind around why this is a thing in our church anymore. How is it leading us closer to Jesus when, you know, maybe the universal church would be better off telling us to fast from social media or something else that would actually bring us closer to God?
Absolutely. And I really appreciate the question. And when you write your manual on the spiritual life, and I hope you do, I recommend that you suggest the fasting from social media, right? I mean, and you'll find Catholic spiritual writers that say such things. And of course, when you read the ancient ascetical treatises of the Desert Fathers and those like them, the fasts and the penances they did were obviously much more extensive than merely those fasts that were taken on for Lent. I mean, their whole life was a life of fasting, right? Their whole life was a life of penance, of abnegation. And so you're absolutely right that if the point of the canon is to give us the best ascetical regime possible to orient us to Jesus and to subdue the power of the flesh, mere abstention from meat seems not to fit the bill, right? And the rationale that you gave is the correct one, that in the ancient world, meat was understood to be a luxury food, and it's very expensive to produce. That remains to be the case, which is why when you raise the economic level of any civilization, one of the first things to change behaviorally is meat production goes way up and meat consumption goes way up. That's kind of universally the case. Unfortunately, so does junk food, right? That also goes up. And so that's why. That's why the fathers got rid of it. Now, you know, St. Thomas adds another argument. That's not as crazy as it sounds. St. Thomas, when he looks at the rationale for meat, speculates that certain kinds of foods have the capacity to affect us neurologically. He doesn't use the word neurology because he doesn't have that concept, but you know, he's still thinking in terms of the four humors. But nevertheless, that the constitution of the human body could be affected by foods in such a way that it could, one food rather than another, could incite the passions. Now, while Thomas's physiology is wrong, his conclusion is correct, and modern science actually does vindicate that perspective, that certain dietary regimes will ignite craving in the personality more than others, right? And so there is another rationale for fasting and for being thoughtful and mindful about what you eat. How should you interpret it, given that it's maybe not the most rigorous thing you could do? It is a symbol. It's a symbol. It's there to evoke in you the recognition, I should do something different with the way I eat. That's it. Like you're correct. If you give up hamburgers and you just switch to the, you know, to the, what's the?
Filet-O-Fish sandwich.
The Filet-O-Fish sandwich. I was trying to think of the name. If you switch from hamburgers to Filet-O-Fish and you load on the tartar sauce with an extra piece of fries and then one of those apple pies after the fact and a big, you know, 20-ounce Coke, it's really not going to affect your soul. I mean, you're right. But if you go into the thing thinking, you know, this is a season of the year for me to fast, to pray, to practice abnegation, to grow closer to Jesus. And the mere fact that there is a command, that there is a precept of the church that you should give something up, namely meat, if that evokes in you an awareness that this reality needs to penetrate more deeply into my personality, and then you do something about it, well, then it would have served its effect. So why not simply command the most effective regime, right? If it's just a symbol, why not make something deeper? Well, the church is very realistic, and she asks the bare minimum. She really does. She asks the bare minimum. That's why the precepts of the church are go to Mass, support the church financially, go to communion once a year, go to confession once a year. It's a bare minimum. It doesn't make it the ideal.
God bless you, Mark. Thanks so much for the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. This Sunday morning, it happens. We go back to daylight savings time. This is the dangerous time shift. I remember as a much younger man working in retail and waltzing in casually on a Sunday for my shift, selling shoes at a large department store in a downtown large metropolitan area, and was horrified to find the store open and bustling with business by the time I rolled in because I didn't set my clock ahead before I went to bed. So this is the one. You will be late for Mass if you do not fix your clock before you go to bed the night before. This Saturday night, you have been warned.
You know, before the advent of the cell phone, and our young people today, they've never lived in a world without cell phones. But before the cell phone, the way I learned about daylight savings is I was predictably either late or early to Mass twice a year.
Yeah.
You know, well, church. I was not Catholic then. I went to church. It was always Sunday, and I would show up an hour early, an hour late for church. That's how I knew, invariably.
Jocelyn is up next, a first-time caller in Houston, Texas, listening on the Amazon Echo. Jocelyn, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hey, doctor.
Hi.
Okay, so my question is that I was saying that my husband was born and raised in Mexico, and so he went to church over there. So obviously a lot of the, Catholicism is the same, but there's a lot of, like, quote-unquote culture things that they do differently.
Oh, sure.
And so now that I take my kids to church, we have a really hard time because sometimes the Eucharistic ministry, because there's so many people in Mass, now they're helping, which to me is common sense, but he gets upset because he doesn't quote-unquote think that it's right that we go to the Eucharistic ministers.
Okay, thanks. The technical term is extraordinary ministry of the Eucharist. Technically, the Eucharistic minister, the ordinary minister, is the priest.
Or the deacon.
Or deacon, right, and then the clergyman, put it that way. And the lay people who are brought in as associates in that process are technically not ministers of the Eucharist. They're extraordinary, out of the ordinary ministers. Now, why would someone have an objection to the use of extraordinary ministers? Well, it's a novel innovation in the life of the church. So before the reforms of the Second Vatican Council, you didn't have extraordinary ministers of the Eucharist. And so people who are, sort of deeply attached to traditional forms may take offense at the idea that they're extraordinary ministers and hold back from it. Now, my answer to that is that if the church allows it, it's okay. I mean, because it's not my private judgment or my antiquarianism or my sense of tradition that defines the Orthodox living and practicing of the Catholic faith. It is, in fact, the magisterium of the church. Even when it runs flat counter to my intuitions, if the magisterium says this is okay, then it's okay. We can do it, okay? It's okay to have your private preference. And if you want to get in the main line, down the center aisle at church, not go to the wings, you can do that. It might gum up the works a little bit if everybody did that, but it's not, you're not really hurt anything. But to tell someone else that they can't receive communion from an extraordinary minister, I think is inappropriate because the church says that you can, and you don't want to impose on someone else's conscience something that the church itself does not impose. Now, there is one exception that I'll throw out there. There are certain things that priests can do in giving out communion that extraordinary ministers cannot do. Principally, extraordinary ministers cannot give blessings. They do all the time, or they pretend to. Right? It's very common, you know, for someone who comes up with their arms crossed or a child comes up for communion, that the well-meaning, well-intentioned, poorly formed extraordinary minister says, you know, may Almighty God bless you, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They can't be doing that. Should not be doing that. And so if I had a child and I was going to bring them up for communion, you know, to receive a blessing from the priest, and I saw the extraordinary minister doing that business, I would switch lines personally, right, rather than subject my child to that very mild but well-intentioned but nevertheless incorrect liturgical abuse. But apart from that, or anything else where the lay people attempt to supplant the prerogatives of the clergy, this is not one of those things that falls into that category. It's okay because the church says it's okay.
So, Jocelyn, I have some information about you that all of our listeners will not necessarily have, and you are a first-time caller. I mentioned that, but why are you listening to us?
Well, I was saying that I'm a first-time listener, or first-time calling in, because my mom would listen to this radio station when I was younger. But for Lent, our whole family in general, with the exception of my husband, because he works like at a construction site, so obviously it's a lot harder. But my children and myself, we gave up any music from anyone else that doesn't have to do with God. So my kids are, you know, hitting it up with Forrest Frank or whatever. But so, and I kind of got tired of listening to the same thing over and over. And I remembered my mom would listen to this radio station when I was younger. So I tuned in, and it's crazy because I tuned in to this exact show today.
Woohoo! Fantastic.
Well, God bless you, Jocelyn. We're here every day, Monday through Friday. Don't forget. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number. Sue is in the great state of North Dakota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Sue, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Hi. I was wondering what things to say to someone that I love, my godchild, who she's been considering the last 2 years of entering a same-sex marriage, and she put it off both times, but now she's seriously considering doing it again. And I talked to her father, and I think he was going to, like, support it, but after I talked to him and said, it's so serious, don't, you know, just talk to her and try to get her not to, he said he doesn't want her, I mean, essentially, he doesn't want her to either. I don't know what things, because I know she's going to talk to me. She's had Catholic education all the way through college, but she got into this real liberal group, and I guess kind of feels like, well, this is the way I was born. I don't have to do this. You know, I can do what I want.
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. I have some thoughts. And it sounds like, you know, you're going to approach this very sensitively. You know, normally when people have values different from ours and we just come with a frontal assault, it's rarely successful in changing their minds. And so finding a way to appeal to values that you share and maybe open up things they hadn't thought about is probably the most effective way if you're going to change someone through dialogue alone. So here's some things that one might consider. So, of course, the reason that there is an institution called marriage in the world, not just in the United States in the 21st century, but historically, has very little to do with romance or sexual attraction. And it is entirely about procreation and the caring and legitimacy and social networks of children. And because babies come into the world through the male-female procreative union, there is an institution around that union that protects those relationships and sets them off from the rest of society because that's unique. It's a relationship unlike adventitious relationships that arise, you know, just because of common interests. Like, you know, no one would dream of calling tennis partners married just because they share a common interest. And it's equally arbitrary to say that two people who are sexually attracted to one another, that's a sufficient ground for marriage or the interpretation thereof, because that is ultimately not the reason that there is a thing called marriage, why societies hallow it or how it's going to flourish. And the minute you single out sexual attraction rather than the raising of children, Well, then you really destroy the basis of marriage, because sexual attraction is a thing that wanes and changes over time and is not constant, whereas values and commitments are, right? Now, the other thing is to look at some of the outcomes of children who have been raised in such families. Some of the resources you might want to look at are Mark Regneris, Catholic sociologist, The New Family Structure Study, that actually looks at the sociological outcomes of non-traditional families and compares them to the male-female procreative union, and it's not pretty. And then at the narrative level, if you can dig this up, some of the amicus briefs filed in Supreme Court cases on gay marriage from children raised in those situations, talking about the deficits they suffered by not having parents of opposite sexes.
It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders.